Good afternoon. I just want to begin by thanking ISID and Phil and your team, Monica, Ian, and Cheryl, for inviting me here and making it possible for me to come and giving me a warm welcome to cold Canada. I left Nairobi when it was 30 degrees centigrade, so this was a bit of a shock to the system. To thank my fellow presenter in this panel and the other presenters who've gone before, as well as all of you for making it this far. Thank you for your resilience. I hope my presentation being the last will be worth your while. I want to speak about the Kenyan Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission and just begin where Aldo also began, about the invitation I got and saw that Kenya was categorized as one of those countries that did not have a truth commission. And I did the same thing as, you know, write and say, well, Kenya has had a truth commission. As I was writing that note, I began wondering whether this was not a Freudian slip, categorizing Kenya as one of those countries that didn't have a truth commission, because as it will be clear by the end of my presentation, it is doubtful what the efficacy of that truth commission has been. I don't want to take it for granted that everyone knows where Kenya is, and so there is Kenya in relation to the map of Africa. A few facts about Kenya. It's in East Africa. It's a country of 42 million people. It is the biggest economy in East and Central Africa, and regarded as the gateway to East Africa, partly because the port of Mombasa serves not only Kenya, but landlocked Uganda, Rwanda, Eastern DRC, and South Sudan. It has been independent from Britain for the last 50 years. And at independence, or shortly thereafter, the biggest opposition political party, the Kenya African Democratic Union, voluntarily dissolved itself and joined the ruling party, Kenya National African Union, or KANU. And KANU ruled as the single party from independence until 2002. Multipartism was effectively banned in 1969. And between 1982 and 1992, the constitution was actually amended to make it illegal to form any other party in the country. And those are the years also that coincided with the highest forms of repression, including torture, political assassinations, and others that I shall be speaking about in a minute. In 2002, KANU was finally defeated after 39 years in power. For the last, those 50 years that I've spoken about, after 11 general elections, Kenya has actually, to its credit, has been a nominal democracy. After those 11 general elections, we've only had four presidents, because the first president ruled for 15 years. The second one stayed for 24 years, after which we introduced term limits. So the third president served for 10 years, and then the fourth president was elected last year and is just about to, actually it's about 1 year since he was elected into office. The fourth president happens to be the son of the first president. And that's important because of what we'll be talking about with regard to the Truth Commission. In the year 2007, Kenya had the most closely contested presidential election, and the opposition leader was declared to have lost by about 2,000 votes, and he rejected the results, and this resulted in widespread violence, which has commonly come to be referred to as post-election violence, or PEV. And this is where we join the story with regard to the Kenyan Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission. Now, during the violence that followed the 2007 election, over 1,000 people were reported to have been killed, and 600,000 were displaced. There were about 1,000 cases of sexual and gender-based violence. There was widespread destruction of property and livelihoods. And Kenya was on the brink of a full-scale civil war when the international community under the auspices of the African Union formed a panel of eminent African personalities led by Kofi Annan to mediate the crisis. And I said earlier that Kenya is the largest economy in the region, is a gateway to the region, has underwritten some of the peace processes in Somalia and Sudan, also was until that point regarded as an island of stability in an otherwise very volatile region. And I think this is important because this got the international community scurrying to our help because particularly for the Americans, I think they, although they didn't say this, but I just imagine they could afford to have another failed state next to Somalia since at that time their single item on the agenda, especially with regard to Africa, seems to have been the prevention of terrorism. And so it was important to stabilize Kenya, and therefore I think that turned out to be our blessing because other African countries have engaged in the sort of activities we engaged in at that time and not lived to tell the tale. So when Kofi Annan came, he very quickly put the negotiating teams together and identified four major agenda items that guided the conversation. And the four were the ending of the violence that was underway at the time. That was in January 2008. Then there was need to deal with the humanitarian crisis. As I've said, there were over 500,000 people on the move. Then there was the need to deal with the humanitarian, the political crisis, because one half of the country had voted one way and the other half the other way. And it was largely accepted that the winner takes all approach would not work this time round. And so the political crisis was resolved by agreeing to a coalition government, a broad-based government that brought all the parties together, headed by the person who had been declared president, who was the incumbent, and the person who was declared to have lost, the challenger, accepted the position of prime minister, which was newly created to resolve this crisis. And then, had it been left up to the politicians, that's where we would have stopped. But civil society was very active in pushing to leverage this crisis to deal with some of the long-term issues that we had been pushing for, including constitutional reform that had stalled for 20 years, legal and institutional reforms. Land has always been at the center of Kenya's perennial crisis, so we thought that it needed to be dealt with. Youth unemployment, the youth had been used as a fodder for the violence, poverty, inequality, regional economic imbalance, and so on. There was also agreement to set up three key commissions. One was the Commission of Inquiry into Post-Election Violence, or CPEV, and an independent review of elections commission to look at the election process, and then a Truth, Justice, and Reconciliation Commission. The first two were short-term commissions that lasted for 3 months and made their reports. The first one, CPEV, found that crimes against humanity had been committed during post-election violence, and it recommended the formation of a special tribunal, internationalized tribunal based in Kenya, to prosecute those who were perpetrators, and gave definite timelines, and then made a recommendation to Kofi Annan that should the special tribunal not be set up, then Kofi Annan was requested to pass on a sealed envelope of suspected perpetrators to the International Criminal Court. And eventually that is what happened because the political establishment failed to form the special tribunal. The other commission on the review of elections made certain recommendations, including a disbandment of the electoral management body and its replacement with an interim body, new registration of voters, and a raft of other electoral reforms. And then the TJRC. The Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission actually made its entry into the Kenyan lexicon 5 years earlier, after the KANU government was defeated in 2002. The new government formed a special task force to conduct a study and hearings to find out if Kenyans wanted the formation of a Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission to look into the past 39 years of KANU governance. I think at this point it's good to say that the fact that this new government, which we all celebrated to the extent that Kenyans were voted to be the most hopeful people on the planet at that point, the fact that this new government decided to form a task force so that they could figure out whether we needed a truth commission should have sent the danger signs for us. Because if you want to form a truth commission in a country that everyone acknowledged there had been serious violations of human rights, then nothing would have been easier than just to form one. But it wasn't formed. There was a task force headed by Professor Makau Mutua, currently Dean of the Law Faculty at State University of New York. And he went around and did a very good job and produced a report that said that over 90% of the Kenyans they had spoken to wanted a truth commission. And they presented their report. And the government, which was formed and included some previous reformers, just sat on the report. And then we came to realize that KANU had been replaced by a party that was called National Rainbow Coalition, or NARC. And so over time, we came to think that NARC actually meant nothing actually really changed. Now, following the post-election violence, I mean, this debate died in 2003. But following post-election violence, the debate about having a TJRC was revived. But it came up, it was revived in a sense almost as a way of being a dumping basket for all the things that negotiators could not immediately agree upon during the Kofi Annan process. And so it ended up with an unrealistically broad mandate, and I shall show that later, but without the necessary political support to carry it through. The TJRC became the poor cousin of Kenya's transitional justice process because the main focus was on power sharing and also the CPEV proposals, especially when the ICC got involved. And then there was no proper sequencing with regard especially to criminal justice as well as truth-seeking, because they took off at the same time, and although there were two different processes, there was a sense in which the Truth Commission was regarded suspiciously as the politician's option of justice light, a way to whitewash what had taken place in Kenya. The early challenges that the Truth Commission faced, the first one is what I call the Kiplagat controversy. When the chairperson of the Truth Commission, former Ambassador Bethuel Kiplagat, was appointed, first of all, the process itself was very rushed and not inclusive. And so it was only after he was named chair that a controversy about his own past came to the fore. Ambassador Kiplagat had served in very senior positions during the worst years of repression of the Moi government, including being ambassador to Paris and London and being permanent secretary in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He was mentioned with regard to the murder of the foreign minister he served under. He was mentioned with regard to a massacre that had taken place in the 80s in the north, and with regard to irregular acquisition of public land. All those issues were supposed to be investigated by the commission he was named to chair. And so when this controversy broke out, there was a loss of support as key civil society organizations withdrew and focused their attention on trying to get him to step down. There was also a loss of momentum at a time when the commission should have been setting up and conducting outreach. It got distracted by trying to get Kiplagat out. And there was also loss of funding because donors took a wait-and-see attitude to see whether this crisis would be resolved. And while there was no direct political interference from the government, there were clear hints that the political establishment preferred Kiplagat to remain as a gatekeeper for the old order. Because at one point, due to the pressure that came upon him, he actually wrote a resignation letter. And when he went to present it to the Minister of Justice, it was the Minister of Justice who actually persuaded him not to go. Also, civil society organizations petitioned the then Chief Justice to appoint a tribunal, as he was required to do under the Act, to probe the chairperson, but it took the Chief Justice 13 months to set up the tribunal to probe Kiplagat. And it was only then that Kiplagat temporarily stepped down, but he immediately went to court and obtained an injunction against the tribunal. And then the tribunal, the 3 months that the tribunal had been given, expired without the tribunal conducting any hearings because of the injunction. And then Kiplagat went back to court and said he had now been cleared by the tribunal since it had expired without a finding against him. And lo and behold, the court agreed with him and said he could go back. So he went back and chaired the commission for the rest of its stay. So those were some of the early challenges of the commission. The mandate of the commission, and that slide is deliberately busy, because I want you to have an appreciation of just the earlier issue I was talking about, that the TJRC was now being used as a dumping basket for all the issues that politicians who were in a hurry to form a joint government could not immediately deal with. And so the TJRC under the Act was mandated to investigate, analyze, and report upon gross violations of human rights that had taken place between 1963 and 2008. And these included all those, abductions, disappearances, detentions, blah, 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 everything in the kitchen sink. And then to also deal with the context, causes and circumstances under which violations and abuses had occurred, inquire into, investigate, and provide redress in respect of, and educate and engage public on issues around its work. The Kenya Truth Commission is, a lot of people talk positively about it, that it was the first truth commission to have a mandate on social and economic rights, and that may be the case, but it was so overburdened with so many other things that there was no realistic chance that it was going to actually contribute much with regard to Kenya's transition to democracy. In the end, the TJRC did its work. It collected 42,000 statements and 1,500 memoranda. It conducted public hearings, both public and private hearings, over a 1 year period. It also conducted some thematic hearings on access to justice, economic marginalization, land, armed militia, and so on and so forth. The commission sought three extensions, which was itself problematic because while the law required them to give proper reasons for seeking extensions, they would negotiate these extensions quietly behind closed doors with the Minister for Justice. And the Minister for Justice then became the champion for seeking an extension for them through Parliament. And this further undermined the public confidence with the Commission. But after these three extensions, eventually the Commission handed over its final report to the President in May last year. But this was not until after one final controversy, because as the commission was doing its work, we had in the meantime held our election, and Uhuru Kenyatta, the son of the first president, had been elected president. And so he was the one who was to receive the final report of the commission, the Truth Commission. Before he did so, people in his office demanded to see an advance copy of the report. and one was surreptitiously given to them. And then they called the commission and they demanded that certain parts of the report that said that the president's father, when he served as the first president, had illegally acquired some prime property at the coastal city of Mombasa. The mandarins in the office of the president demanded that some of those sections be excised from the report before the president could accept it. And the commission, the Kenyan TJRC had 9 commissioners, 6 nationals and 3 internationals. And the 3 international commissioners refused to acquiesce to the demand that the land chapter be changed to accommodate the whims of the president's office. But the Kenyan nationals, who are 8 by this time because the vice chair had resigned over the Alia Kiplagat controversy, the Kenyan commissioners were happy to go along and change the report, which they did. But this meant that the international commissioners refused to sign the final report. And so the final report was submitted in May. But while the law was very clear that once the report was submitted, it gave specific timelines through which it should be tabled in Parliament and an implementation committee was supposed to be established. Instead of doing that, the Parliament, which is dominated by the President's party, went ahead and changed the law that had set up the commission to give themselves power to reopen the report to change the parts that they did not like. So we are waiting for the report now to be tabled to Parliament, which I'm sure will use this new power to remake it in their own image. So whose truth and what reconciliation with regard to the Kenyan TJRC? In the case of Kenya, the truth with regard to most of the atrocities that the TJRC was to investigate was already largely well known, partly because the Kenyan state has a habit of forming commissions of inquiry to deal with issues that when they are under pressure. But they normally do that as just a pressure valve. We've had over 35 commissions of inquiry, but most of them either don't report or the reports are never made public, or when they're made public, they're never implemented. But we've also had a very vibrant media, and they've done very many exposés about some of the issues that the truth needed to be looked into. So the truth was largely well known. So the value added for the Truth Commission should have been that the victims needed official acknowledgement by the state and individual perpetrators, as well as reparations for what they had suffered. This was never really done by the Truth Commission. Instead, the Truth Commission vaguely recommended further investigations instead of telling the truth. So we've got people who've waited 50 years or 40 years or 30 years to know what is the official truth, what happened, and the Truth Commission comes and says, we need further investigations. Not very helpful. The report, however, has an impressive reparations framework because this was done by civil society organizations which gave a draft to the TJRC, but there is little chance of implementation of this framework given what I've just said about what Parliament is doing. What about reconciliation? And this is my second last slide, I believe. Perpetrators largely stayed away. And so one wonders what kind of reconciliation there can be when there hasn't been much of a dialogue between perpetrators and victims. Former President Moi, who served for 24 years and during whose term the height of repression took place, instead of being summoned as a witness, he instead summoned the commissioners to tea, to his house, to have a cup of tea, to explain how Kenya was so lucky to have him as president during a time when most countries were breaking down after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And then there was no serving government official who was summoned to appear, despite the fact that there are many who are known to have been perpetrators. It was a largely one-sided conversation of the victims. And as I said earlier, the report so far has been ignored. Instead of implementation, Parliament has enacted a law to reopen the report and amend it. Finally, what are the lessons and challenges from Kenya? I would say that one of them is that Kenya missed its opportunity to set up a proper TJRC, Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission, in 2002, when we went on a frolic and set up a task force instead of going ahead and setting the TJRC. This would have been the right time because we had just had an election that got rid of the ruling party for the last 39 years, and therefore we could have drawn a line in the sand and said our nunca mas, but clearly that was not to be. And therefore, when it came to 5 years later, when the Truth Commission was finally established, there was no transitional moment because we had impetus without uptake. We set up as a way of just ticking the box and pleasing the international community by saying, look, we have a commission. I mean, Truth Commissions are can be important tools of transition. I think we've all agreed that. But I hope I'm not being too cynical that particularly in Africa, they are becoming more and more, they look more and more like international airports. Each country wants to have its own. So when a country has a crisis of some sort, they come in and say, oh yeah, let's have a truth commission. And there isn't a proper thought process that has gone into it. There's no policy proposals. It's just a question of, oh, they had one in South Africa. Let's have one here too. Then the third challenge was a very weak legislative framework. In Kenya, it was drafted very opaquely. We had the possibility of involving experts in the actual drafting, but that was not done. It uncritically copied and pasted the South African model. It gave unrealistic timelines for setting up and an overbroad mandate. Fourthly, I referred earlier to sequencing challenges. The TJRC came before we got our new constitution, so there was a guessing game that the TJRC was involved in, not quite knowing whether the proposals made in the new constitution would be able to pass at the referendum in 2010, and what the implications of that would be to the TJRC's own work and to Kenya's overall democratic project. But also there were, as I said earlier, there was a parallel ICC process that was underway at that time, which also tended to distract from the attention from the TJRC. And then I talk about the relationship with government. I referred to that a little earlier with the Minister for Justice. The relationship with, the troubled relationship with civil society organizations and victim groups. Earlier today, Marjorie from South Africa talked about the victims in South Africa being lost in transition. I think our whole TJRC was lost in transition in Kenya because as I said, we missed the opportunities in 2003. It became a poor cousin and a ticking the box approach in 2009. The achievements that have been made in the Kenyan Democratic Project have been made in spite of the TJRC. The TJRC has had nothing to do with them. For instance, we have a new constitution that was voted into place in a referendum in 2010. There have been successful court cases by some victims of torture. There has also been a successful case in Britain that was filed by the Mau Mau freedom fighters and that was settled late last year. And all those were happening in spite of the TJRC. The TJRC had no part to play. The TJRC itself was broadly ignored by the political elite. The president mentioned it, I think, once when he set it up, and then proceeded to completely and splendidly ignore it. And so did the rest of the political elite. They continued to behave as if there was, nothing happening in town that concerned an important political process. And finally, there's so far been a lack of implementation of the recommendations. As I've said, instead Parliament is busy amending the law to ensure that they are going to be able to change those parts that offend the powers that be, particularly the president, whom, as I've said, comes from a very powerful political family because his father was the first president of the republic. And his father is the one who basically laid the foundation for the Kenyan state, which should stand under trial if we ever have a good Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission. And so I end where I began by asking you and sort of leaving it to you to judge whether the person who had put Kenya under the category of countries that did not have a Truth Commission actually made a Freudian slip, or it was just a harbinger of the things to come. I thank you, and I look forward to engaging further in the Q&A.